It is 8:30, and we have with us, live in our studio, once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning to you both.
It's amazing how we become alive every week, just about this time.
Yes, well, it's partly because I go and open those
sprinkle two little wooden boxes. Sprinkle
and
that little magic dust, right?
Say the proper words and your body's
rise. I never knew you knew Latin like that.
Yeah, is that what that was? That's some kind of
schooling.
Satanic incantation.
Yes.
Mike McCormick still turning heads after all these years.
All right, so good to have you back, Maria. We missed you.
Yes, I'm back and I'm alive and I survived tax season.
Yeah, and now I'm going to be running off. I'm going to be gone the next couple of weeks. Little Rock, Kansas City, Des Moines, St. Louis, and Memphis in the next 2 weeks.
You're taking your show on the road.
I am taking my show on the road, and just ahead of the folks who are going to feather me and run me out of town and all that good stuff. So, you know, the show me state. I'm going to be out and around and talking and doing some family stuff at the same time, and be back in a couple weeks.
All right. Well, we'll try and hold down the fort for you.
Oh, you'll do just fine. No more of the days of calling in off of phone booths with big trucks roaring by,
backing up in the background. Beep beep beep. Okay. Well, let's. We got a lot to cover this week, so let's dive into it. Starting with some local stuff. City budget. Is there a crisis on the way?
Yeah, actually there is. Actually, it's not on the way because it's been with us for the past number of years. But once again, this coming year, the city is looking at about a $25 million.
We're still talking city here, federal government.
What I've got is I've got Sound Transit and the monorail on my mind, which is what I'm going to get to next. But the the city is looking at a fairly substantial budget shortfall this time, and that budget shortfall is being exacerbated. There was supposedly this newfound harmony between Greg Nichols and City Council after the last election this past fall, where they were going to be working together more closely, and it's like, you know, Nichols laid down the law during his first year or two in office, and now it's going to be this cooperative, and they'll sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya. It's not working out that way, and the reason it's not working out that way is that Greg Nichols is not exactly being Mr. Fiscal Responsibility. He's going out and funding a lot of his own pet projects and also talking at the same time about no new taxes, no new revenue streams for the city. And the city and the city council, which is the final legislative body that has to hammer out the budget for the city and has to make the tough cuts, largely in recent years to social services and services for the poor and indigent in this city, is increasingly being left holding the bag because the estimate for how much is the budget deficit is going to be has been steadily increasing over the past several months, and it kind of came to a head with the release of the numbers this week as to just how dire the situation has become. That supposedly after we went through and made all those difficult cuts last year, it wasn't supposed to be as bad this year. And in fact, it looks like it'll be just as bad this time around.
Yeah, this is for the 2005 budget, $25 million gap. At least half of that is related to inflation-related adjustments. So current spending with an inflation factor added in. But the other half is for things like running the new public libraries, maintaining transportation services, Greg Nichols' pet project to put in new parking meters or new parking pay stations. That's going to chew up another $1 million.
The ones that can take your credit cards.
Right. And then $1 million to fund new park facilities. And then the police came up with about $1 million in unanticipated costs that they're going to need for next year, although there's not much detail as to what that is.
Yeah, I was going to say, have they raised any mention of what that detail is? Because
no.
I haven't seen it.
No. And
I think it might be related to protests.
It might. It actually might.
It very well could, or just the acquisition of a lot of the spending
of
in the police department in recent years has been the new high tech toys for crowd control and for emergency and SWAT type operations.
Now, just to put this in a little bit of perspective, just last month the city council had to cut about $9.3 million out of the current year's budget. They had to make a mid-year adjustment because they were running short of funds. And since 2001, the city has cut about a total of $100 million out of the budget.
Yeah, one of the other things that has come up this year also is that they keep making estimates of revenues that they're going to come in on the income side of the coffer based on the idea that the economy is going to recover, and the economy keeps recovering at a more slowly pace, or if you look at it in the other direction, keeps stagnating for a longer time than city economists anticipate.
Now, there's a couple of things going on right now in the city council. Greg Nichols has said that he, as Job mentioned, that he doesn't want to raise taxes. City council members are saying, why don't we just raise property taxes a little bit in order to cover the shortfall? You know, you have to occasionally raise a little more money when you have more expenses. And Nichols
and
is saying,
mind,
no,
we've got this cuts. With a Tim Iman property tax initiative going to be on the ballot this coming fall, too.
Limit local property taxes, yes. And at the same time, Councilman Peter Steinbrück pointed out that Greg Nichols has hired over 1,000 new city employees in the past 8 months, even though the city's supposed to be under a hiring freeze. In addition, Greg Nichols is supporting this big initiative in front of the council to add 11 new playfields to Magnuson Park when there's only money in the old parks levy for about 4 of those fields.
Yeah, and the hiring freeze story was an interesting one, actually, because not only was it that about 1,000 new people have been hired under the hiring freeze, but there's a special officer that approves or rejects each new hiring request, because what happens is that under the hiring freeze, a department that wants to make a hire and can make the case that it's essential to city services, whether it's a policeman or utilities or whatever it is, and makes the case, and then this person says yay or nay as to whether they can go ahead and hire. Something like 1,000 out of 1,100 hiring requests have been approved. So only about 100 or so hiring requests have not been approved under the Nichols administration. It's remarkable. It's an expansion. And this is on the heels of the Shell administration, which had already expanded city hiring quite a bit during the boom years of the late 90s.
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder what would happen if there wasn't a hiring freeze. Boy, they'd really be bringing them in. It'd be a cattle call. All right. Anything else on that, or we move along? No,
let's move on.
We can move on.
The monorail.
Yeah. For people who may have been living in a cave and haven't heard, the monorail has been engaged in an aggressive new advertising campaign. They've had it on TV. They've had it on the radio. They've had it in print. There was a big 2-page spread in Seattle Weekly this week that we were all sitting around in the staff meeting gagging over, because there were so many just egregious misrepresentations. And the gist of the monorail is, it's coming soon. Well, it's not coming soon, number one. And number two, it's not going to alleviate the commute for the vast majority of people in the Seattle area. It's really only designed to serve, at least in its present configuration with the one line that's being built and financed, it's really only designed to serve relatively small populations in West Seattle and Ballard to commute downtown, or to commute back and forth from West Seattle to Ballard. It'll be a very exciting kind of thing. But but there's a lot of good new restaurants and night spots in Ballard. You know, don't laugh. What it is meant to forestall is actually the more interesting thing, because there's an increasing amount of criticism coming up of the monorail project itself, of potential cost overruns, and particularly as site selection has been in process for the different stations. City Council will have to pass muster and approve the various deals that are cut for each of the station site selections. And when I say deals are being cut, what I mean by this is the monorail is set up as a public-private partnership. The way that it is being financed literally depends upon having mixed-use development going on at the different station sites, where the monorail authority works in conjunction with private developers to, you know, develop retail complexes and everything else that'll go in around the different monorail stations, and then presents those and gets the necessary rezone and whatnot in city council. This is why the monorail project is engaging in this aggressive advertising campaign right now, even though nothing's coming up on the ballot, and there's and you know there's also this direct mail piece that showed up in the mail this week that was just this very cryptic thing. Don't let them stop the monorail. Call your city council now. That's what it's about. It's not about stopping the monorail. It's about making sure because the way the monorail is being financed guarantees that private developers will make a profit off of this. And when you've got a wheeler dealer like Joel Horn running the monorail project, you can pretty well rest assured that it's going to be very, very favorable terms for a lot of these developers off of the public dime. This is what the advertising campaign is about. So when you hear those ads in the future, remember what it's about. It's not about stopping the monorail. It's not about we voted for it three times, don't make them vote for us a fourth time. It's about trying to make sure that there's not excessive profit taking being taken by private developers around what's supposed to be a public transit project. Now, we also had some interesting news this week around Sound Transit, where they finally came to agreement, at least to the U-District portion of the northern route going up from downtown. The southern route is already under construction, and that was the one that the development of which was just a farce for several years in the late 90s and early 00s. They had not agreed on a route yet to go north to the University District and then on to Northgate. They still haven't decided on Northgate, and for that reason, they didn't take a final vote. The Sound Transit Board did not on Thursday night, but they are planning to take it next month and hope to have the agreement on the Northgate end of it done by then. But they have agreed on a route to go up to as far as 45th and Brooklyn Avenue in the U District. There are only a handful of outstanding questions remaining. But one of the most notable things about Sound Transit so far in its development of the northern route is we've heard a great deal over the past few years about, oh, well, you know, they had kind of a rocky start, but they brought in this new executive director and the ship has been righted and it's being run in a much more prudent manner and fiscally responsible and all those kind of good things right now and on time and on schedule and all the rest of it. Well, the only problem is that the amount of money that they're going to need to finish Sound Transit is going to be much, much higher than they are projecting. They're projecting right now $2.5 billion for the northern half of this route, when they've already budgeted $2 billion. This is billion with a B, which was my confusion with the city budget. $2 billion for the southern half. The northern half is all going to be underground. It means digging a tunnel from downtown all the way underneath Capitol Hill, all the way under the Montlake Cut, which has got to be extremely deep. The University of Washington didn't want the route.
They chose one of the more expensive options to go north,
Yeah,
too, didn't they?
And the reason they chose one of the more expensive options is the University of Washington did not want Sound Transit going underneath the medical center. They wanted to be able to reserve the right for the medical center to expand down in the future.
Yeah,
and so it's
going to
stop at Husky Stadium and,
right.
then go up from that. But that's
right.
The most expensive place they could have crossed the Montlake.
Yeah, and it makes you ask, you know, is it really worth it in order to deliver a few hundred or a few thousand maybe, but more likely just a few hundred people to the football games every once in a while.
Yeah, what 6-7 times a year, as a matter of fact. And beyond that, you know, you're talking about a project where most of the ridership estimates that they're getting are being drawn off the bus lines. The buses, the number 7 that runs from downtown to Capitol Hill to the U District, which is what the northern route overlaps, is the most heavily trafficked bus route in the city.
Well, actually doesn't overlap the number 7 route. Only overlaps the number 7 route to Broadway, which is served by other bus routes too. It overlaps the number 43 route at the Montlake Cut.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right about that. But there's a 43 that goes on to the U District. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
But
But during Husky game days, they usually just, the Metro usually just drafts special shuttles,
yeah,
and that's worked pretty well.
What I'm talking about is the normal flow of traffic, whereby most people aren't going to be going to Husky Stadium. They're going to be going to or from the U District,
right,
and
right,
Capitol Hill and downtown, and those are the heavily trafficked bus routes of the city.
Right, and that's not the route that they chose. They chose instead to have one stop at the north end of Broadway. They had one stop down on Pill Hill around Madison, and then they're going to have one stop at the Montlake Cut over by the Husky Stadiums. And it seems to me a huge, enormous waste of money to just deliver a few hundred football fans a few times a year.
Well, and
given that they have to drill more deeply in order to appease the university.
The point that I was making is that the bulk of those riders are going to be people going between point A, downtown, point B, Capitol Hill, or point C, the University District, and that is already a heavily transited corridor,
mm-hmm,
that most people aren't using cars to get between those points already, so it's not taking cars off the roads.
No, that's true.
Well, and of course, the first stop will actually be at the bank, so let's move on. The you predicted it, Washington primaries getting challenged.
Yeah, this just very briefly, to cover this very quickly. The top two primary option was what was passed by the legislature, but in that bill earlier this year, they included a little option that if Governor Gary Locke vetoed that version because they knew Gary Locke didn't like the top two primary option, that then the Montana-style system would come into effect, and that's the version that Gary Locke favors. He did, a couple weeks ago, veto the top two portion of the bill, which meant that then the Montana-style primary is what we would have for the next primary. However, as Jav and I both predicted, the critics of the Montana-style system are now suing Governor Gary Locke and the state, because they're saying that the veto is unconstitutional. And you can just bet that this is going to put on hold any kind of plan for our primary system. So it'll be kind of interesting to see. A judge hasn't heard the suit yet and hasn't ruled yet whether or not the Montana-style system will have to be put on hold or if anything is going to be done to replace it for this next primary, but it's going to be a mess this year.
Yeah, they're going to have to expedite this ruling, or the state certainly will try and expedite this ruling, as will the people who brought the suit, because they will want to have an answer in time to prepare for the September primary.
All right. Well, moving along, I guess we can't expect the James Yee story to be coming to TV anytime soon, huh?
Well, if it does, you can bet that Yee himself will not have a speaking part.
Very briefly, remind us who James Yee is.
Yeah, James Yee is the Muslim chaplain who was in the army, who was accused last fall of all sorts of egregious spy and treason charges for presumably taking out sensitive papers, dealing with his hearing the hearing the spiritual concerns of Muslim prisoners of war, detainees at Guantanamo Bay, an extremely obviously sensitive position for him to be in. And the charges that were originally lodged against him were quite spectacular in nature. They carried the death penalty. He was kept in solitary confinement for 76 days, often manacled. And then one by one, the charges dropped away. And for a while, they added on charges of adultery and pornography, basically as sort of a butt covering once the original espionage charges were proven to be frivolous. And then those charges eventually were also dropped. Finally, last month, the Army just said, well, kind of never mind, and sent him back to his original home base, which is down the road here in Fort Lewis. Well, this month, Captain Yee got a gag order, basically, ordering him not to talk about any of his experiences about his case or about his views of the military. The problem is that the gag order doesn't actually say any of that. What it tells him, and I have a copy of the letter, actually, and I wrote about this on the not with me right now, but wrote about this on the web at workingforchange.com, and then it'll be in the weekly next week also, that he was sent a letter by one of his commanding officers at Fort Lewis, a Lieutenant Colonel Marvin S. Whitaker, and the first thing it does is tell him that he, as a U.S. soldier, has, you know, constitutionally protected rights to free speech. Well, you know, nobody tells you this unless they're about to take your constitutionally protected rights to free speech away, and that is exactly what the letter goes on to do. It goes on to tell him, quote, this is a direct quote, that speech that undermines the effectiveness of loyalty, discipline, or unit morale is not constitutionally protected. Such speech includes, but is not limited to, disrespectful acts or language, however expressed, toward military authorities or other officials. It's not like there's any kind of a tradition of disrespectful attitudes toward the military in the military ever. Then there was a long tradition of pornography use and adultery in the military too. So authorities or other officials, adverse criticism of, however expressed toward military authorities or other officials. So if you say something nasty about the president, that could get him court-martialed as well. Adverse criticism of the Department of Defense or Army policy that is disloyal or disruptive to good order is similarly limited. And there was a priceless quote from Yee's lawyer, because, of course, Yee himself can't talk about this either, that it is so vague, this gag order, that the quote from the lawyer was something like, you know, pal, you're walking in a minefield, and we're not going to tell you where the minefields are. And the problem with this, of course, is that it is a butt covering, that that Yee is in the military, which is a public agency, therefore he is a public employee, and yet he cannot talk about this very it would be farcical if it weren't so outrageous the way that he had been treated by the U.S. military. Here's a guy who has some really specialized knowledge. He was a convert to Islam. He studied in Syria. He speaks Arabic fluently. Went and dedicated that to a career in the military. And this is how his country has treated him. And it treated him that way basically because he's, you know, brown skinned and can talk with them. It's what it's almost seems to come down to. It really is problematic that he has not been able to say anything about his treatment, because it's a question of accountability. It's a question of who in the military, and obviously people aren't just threatened with the death penalty, but do die in Iraq every day due to mistakes by the military. Who in the military accepts accountability for when mistakes are made? And when you have everybody up to and including a commander in chief who can't even conceive of the fact that he's ever made a mistake while in office, it really fosters a culture of non-accountability.
All right. Well, finally, we move to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yes, folks will recall that this has been one of the bloodiest last 2 weeks period in Iraq than we've seen since the beginning of the war. 700-plus people have died in Fallujah. There's been no access to hospitals.
Mostly women or children.
Mostly women and children. There's been no access to any hospital in Fallujah. The hospital has been cut off by the U.S. Marine cordon around the city. There are only two small clinics to treat the hundreds of wounded. You don't see much of this reporting in the U.S. press. You have to go to either the Arabic language press or the European press or the alternative press here in the U.S. to occasionally get reports from people who have actually been inside the city to tell you what it's like. And it is pretty bad there. U.S. troop deaths this week.
Do you have any recommendations where people can go for that?
I found some interesting things at alternet.org. I found some interesting stuff at ZNet. I found good things in, well, you can check on Al Jazeera, although they tend to cover more region-wide stuff. They had a little bit on Fallujah. And don't be alarmed by the U.S. military and the Bush administration telling you about how terrible Al Jazeera is. Al Jazeera is run by former BBC employees, and Al Jazeera has been highly praised by other governments around the world for being both very, very good at covering what goes on in the Middle East, but it also presenting both sides of an issue. So yeah. American spokespeople have appeared on Al Jazeera to give the American point of view, as well as people from Arabic regions.
Yeah, it's much more open than a lot of U.S. media, actually.
Yeah, much more open. So that's a good place to go. There are other places you can look at on the BBC. You can look at The Independent and The Guardian in England. You can look at the French press agency reports and also wire service reports, too. But the main news this week, I also want to point out that U.S. troop deaths just this month, just in the first 3 weeks of this month, have gone over 100 soldiers, which is the highest rate of U.S. troop deaths since the war began, higher even than the initial conflict in last March and April. Now, the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman, General Richard B. Myers, told Congress this week that the U.S. occupation is running out of money. Now, folks might remember that the Congress passed a bill, an $87 billion bill, to fund the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, and about three-quarters of that was going to go directly to the U.S. military. Well, it turns out this month that the U.S. military is already dipping into funds that were meant to be spent in July, and military analysts say that we're going to run out of money come midsummer. So that'll be late July, early August. Now, the Bush administration did not include any money at all to fund the U.S. occupation of Iraq in the budget for October 2004 through September 2005. Now, that's an unprecedented way to fund a military occupation. The Bush administration was just going to rely on emergency budget requests. The first one was supposed to come to Congress in January of 2005.
Yeah, after the election.
After the election. But it looks like George Bush has got a problem. That first emergency budget request is probably going to have to come sometime in August or September, right at the very height of the election season. So we'll see what happens when that occurs. Now, not only is the occupation running out of money, it's also running short of troops, too. Folks might remember in the last couple weeks that Spain has said it will withdraw its troops. Spain is one of the larger of the coalition partners. It's going to withdraw about 1,000 to 2,000 troops come about mid-May. Those guys will be gone. And so the U.S. military, because of the current fighting both in the north, in and around Fallujah and Ramadi, and the fighting going on with Shiite militias around Najaf and Karbala and Kufa, have decided to keep about 20,000 U.S. troops there in Iraq. Those troops were supposed to be coming home in the next week or so, but their stay has been extended for at least 3 months. And now there's some question about how we can get more troops in there. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, who sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week, broached the topic of reinstituting a military draft.
Yeah, and there's some support for that among Democrats as well. So
yes.
We're going to hear more about that in the future.
So I just want to remind folks who have teenage sons and daughters at home that it might be a good idea to, you know, on your next holiday, take a little trip north to Canada and check out the place and see if you think you might want to relocate there sometime in the future. So in other Iraq news this week, the Iraqi National Congress named the new head of a tribunal to try Saddam Hussein for crimes against humanity.
By the way, before you get to that, one other thing on troop strains, that the RAND Corporation had a study coming out this week saying that for the security that the United States needs in Iraq, it would need 500,000 troops.
Which is exactly what General Eric Shinseki said at the beginning of the war.
And that's a factor of
four. He lost his job for that.
Yeah, and that's a factor of 4 to 5 more than what the U.S. has there right now.
Yeah, we only have about 135,000 troops there right now. And Donald Rumsfeld is continuing to say, oh, we won't need any more troops, we won't need any more troops. But he's batting zero, you know, as far as his predictions regarding Iraq. So you shouldn't listen to him. So folks might remember, I just said the Iraqi National Congress named the new head of the tribunal to try Saddam. Not the Iraqi Governing Council, but the Iraqi National Congress. That's Ahmed Chalabi's little group of exiles is going to be running the tribunal to try Saddam Hussein for crimes against humanity. Now, human rights groups have pointed out that because Ahmed Chalabi is one of the biggest opponents and longtime opponents of Saddam Hussein, that this is going to make this a partisan affair, not a nonpartisan affair.
It's not exactly
judicial
a jury of your peers.
Trial, yeah, like other such tribunals set up for Rwanda and the Balkans and other places around the world, which have been set up by the UN, have featured international experts on such issues. This is going to be run by people who's have an axe to grind against Saddam Hussein. So, and the new head of the tribunal, by the way, is Salem Chalabi, Ahmed Chalabi's nephew. So that might give you some idea of why both the Sunnis and the Shiites are up in arms against the U.S. right now. Now, on Friday, the imams came out into the mosques all over Iraq, and they gave their sermons, as they do every Friday. And they seem to all have the same message this week, regardless of whether they were Sunnis or Shiites, or even Shiite clerics in Iran said the same thing. They all said that the U.S. has to lift its dual siege on Fallujah and the southern Shiite city of Najaf, or else Iraq is going to explode into violence against the U.S. military occupation. Now, was anybody at the Pentagon listening? No, I don't think so. Nobody at the Pentagon or the White House was listening, because on the same day that Sunni and Shiite clerics all over the country of Iraq and also in Iran gave that message to their people, the Pentagon said, we still have Muqtada al-Sadr as the most wanted man on our list. And they also said, well, the people of Fallujah have to surrender a lot more arms and weapons than they have, and they have to capitulate or else we're going to invade in a few days. So that's what I'm going to leave you with.
I think it's going to be a very nasty week this coming week in Iraq. It really is shaping up that way.
The next couple weeks is going to be bad.
Yeah.
With that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Our bright little bluebirds of cheer.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, etc., all over the area in Seattle and the East Side. And if you want to find us on the web, we're at www.eatthestate.org. If you have questions, comments, tips, or want to volunteer, you can call us at 206-903-9461.